For October 12, 2009, it's the Overthinking It Podcast, episode 67. And don't call me Shirley. Welcome to the Overthinking It Podcast, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. From the edge of America, as Harry Shearer, my idol as a radio broadcaster, likes to say, from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I am your host, Matthew Rather, welcoming you to another edition of the podcast, where the question of the week is, in honor of Columbus Day, when this podcast will be released, what is your favorite depiction of an Italian American?
Pronounce it right.
I'm sorry, Mark. Being a member of an ethnic minority, you are sensitive to the plights of all ethnic minorities. I know.
Yes. Especially my fellow Guido Wops. I mean, what?
Wow.
Italian American.
This was Mark's idea for this topic.
Right,
Mark has an axe to grind.
You know what? You don't need to spew your hate and vitriol out all over our freaking podcast, right?
I'm sorry.
No, what is your favorite depiction of an Italian American? Mark, we're going to let you cool off for a little bit, and we're going to go straight to the first in alphabetical order, Mr. Peter Fenzel. Pete, how's your basement doing?
My basement, it's a party in a box, and that box has a staircase that goes upstairs to another box, which has a door that goes out to the sidewalk. So everything is right with the world. I actually need to start throwing out these diet root beer cans that build up when I podcast and work on the blog, because I'm starting to swim in them a little bit, and that's no good. No good, I say.
Yep. There's a funny story. Like when we there's a little background to this. It was a tradition at the college that we all went to that every year the rising seniors would direct a film full of comedy sketches related to the extracurricular activity that we were all involved in at school. And so when Belinky... Belinky and I and
I like how you can say his name, but you can't mention what club we were in.
No, Belinky and I and McNeil, who is an occasional contributor to the site, Josh McNeil, has been on the podcast before. If you go back, some deep cuts. When we were the unholy trinity at the head of the movie sketches, McNeil, I guess, was really in charge. We survived on cans of Dr. Pepper, cases we would buy at the 7-Eleven, the convenience store around the corner, which was a Krauser's, I guess, at the time. And so we stacked the cans up in the editing room, and we actually reached nearly the ceiling with not the cans, the empty cases, the empty cardboard cases, and we got like I think 15 or 16 cardboard cases of Dr. Pepper. That was our fuel as we were doing it. Is it a similar situation in your basement there where you have like cans reaching up to the ceiling?
Well, it was definitely getting to the point where I tried to make a pyramid the other day, but then I realized that I didn't have a good plan. I didn't have a good way of people talk about making can pyramids as if it's something that everybody knows how to do without any experience or training.
Or you
and this is not the case.
Or like the pharaohs of old, you lacked only Israeli slaves.
Well, gosh, everybody's throwing stones today. Gosh, everybody is mad at all the little the ethnic minorities among the large superset of white people. If I did have a bunch of hard work,
Egyptians were not white people. I don't think they have been at any point.
No, what are you talking about? The Ptolemies were white. These were of Greek extraction. They were Hellenistic. A lot of Egyptians
were
white.
They were Greek. Yeah, okay. They were Greek. Yeah, sure. Okay.
I mean, because there's Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt and the two crowns, and they unite, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, you can read Black Athena, and we can talk about Black Athena and the value of Black Athena, but perhaps that's something we'll save for the podcast when we get an actual black person on it, which we don't have right now.
I want to talk about this. I realize that we have not answered one of the questions, but let's I'm interrupting the I'm going off topic here. And so anyone
much jump... like actual Columbus Day, we will choose to observe or not observe this question as we see fit.
I want to ask about this, right? Like, what is this thing where, you know, we can't talk about any issues related to the African-American experience unless we have an actual honest-to-goodness black person on the podcast, right? Like, you can't, as an observer, make observations about something you observe by observing it and then talking about your observation? Observe, observate?
Easy. Well, we tried that once in a conversation about hip-hop, and I got myself in a lot of trouble. So I've kind of, you know, steered away from that recently.
I just think it's more fun. I think it's more fun because I remember we used to have these big conversations about race in the dining hall back at school, and my one friend – well, no, I have a number of friends who are black, but I have one friend, black friend, who's like an especially close black friend.
I have black friends.
I know you have black friends.
I have gay friends.
I know you do. Look, and now that they can ask and tell to all of their to their heart's content. But what I'm saying is that
– Is that official or has it just been announced that you know, the effort is underway?
I just saw a headline. I didn't read the full story. I think it's the latter. I think that they're putting it in motion, so to speak.
I guess, yeah. It's like in the 2004 election, George Bush acquired political capital that he spent on, you know, reforming Social Security and reforming immigration policies. I guess the Peace Prize gives our president some political capital that he can spend reforming the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Anyway, what is this thing where it's like, well, you know, I'm not a member of the minority group in question, so I suppose my opinion is not legitimate. You're an observer of the culture, you're a smart guy, and your opinion is legitimate on those grounds as an observer, mm-hmm. not necessarily as a participant in the black experience in America, but as an observer.
Well, sure. I think the conversation is more interesting if you bring in people who live it every day. And who might be more experienced with it, who might have part of the problem of it is that sources of information are also segregated, right? So we might not be getting the news, the rumors, the discussions that are happening among the sort of black overthinking community. I'm sure that there's a black overthinking it site out there somewhere that we could – that is separate but equal to our own that we need to somehow integrate with Boston. I mean, I feel like if we have – I'm going to forcibly bust Schechner over to the black overthinking it and forcibly bust one of their guys over here so that we can start integrating this shit. Because, you know, I'm sick and tired of it. There's like this – we had this little girl come to the overthinking it home offices here, and she was pelted with tomatoes. And all that the freaking guy from the Saturday Evening Post could do was paint it. And it was so sad. Why can I not remember that guy's name off the top of my head? You know who I'm talking about.
Norman Rockwell?
Norman Rockwell, yes. I've been blanking on names this week. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, scary.
You know what? It's probably like root beer toxicity.
That's probably true. I totally didn't stick the landing on a Leni Riefenstahl joke last night because I couldn't remember her name. Sorry. It's like, oh, you know, blah, 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 blah. Offensive Nazi commentary. And the name is, no, it's not there. And you failed. So to answer your question, Marissa Tomei in My Cousin Vinny. As Mona Lisa Vito has got to be my favorite depiction of a fictional Italian American, partly because it's one of my favorite depictions of anyone anywhere. I love her performance in that part. I think it's a performance as, you know, actresses and actors are in the business of making you fall in love with them. And I think that that's definitely a part which does that. I think that's a part, you know, she won the Oscar for it. I've heard lately, although I had not heard between 1992 and now, I've heard lately people claiming that this was somehow undeserved, like including Marissa Tomei in a list of actresses that didn't deserve their Oscar. And I would like to stamp that out before it spreads too far, because she deserved that Oscar like nobody's business. It's a wonderful, wonderful depiction. If you haven't seen My Cousin Vinny, which is a Joe Pesci movie about Ralph Macchio is arrested for it was a robbery of some sort. And Joe Pesci is sort of a skunky low rent lawyer who's their relative who comes in to try to defend them. And Marissa Tomei plays his like sweet, you know, sort of
it's set in the South. These guys are like, these guys are New York Italian guys.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's ethnic caricature going on, but I think much like in The Karate Kid, which Mark and I had that sort of back and forth on earlier, the ethnic caricature is there on purpose in order to set in sharp relief the differences that the people are having and the fish out of water experience that the protagonist is going through.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, in fact, I actually just gave you guys a little tip if you're thinking about a possible answer for this question of somebody that you might want to mention, but I won't go farther into that detail. I'll just say that My Cousin Vinny is great.
Wait, Mr. Miyagi is an Italian.
That's very correct. Although Arnold was. Arnold from Happy Days was Italian.
Speaking of tokenism and having black people on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got a Twitter direct message from our guest last week, Amanda Marcotte, saying that she had a great time on the show and is willing to be our token woman periodically on the show, which I think is fantastic because we had a great time. We had a great time having her.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she has the soul of an overthinker, and I was honored and pleased that she came on here. I think she did a great job, and anytime she wants to tell us more stories about the next stories.
Wow. And now she's no longer willing. So.
Exactly.
No.
Is this what we're going to do again, where we joke taunt the woman until she gets it and leaves? I don't want to do that again. We've done that to every woman who collaborated with us.
Who did we do to that to last time?
Well, we do it to Shayna constantly, where we joke taunt Shayna.
I mean, I don't know. Shayna knows us from of old.
Shayna, I don't know. What is that supposed to mean? You mean Shayna has known us for like 10 years and is fine with us?
Yeah, I mean, if Shayna thought we were like really that offensive as sexist bastards, like Shayna would have opted out a long time before joining up with Overthinking at Sight in the first place.
Right.
Yes. So, so that's exciting news, right? Write us and tell us what you think of that and that you're excited about it because we are as well. Not that we are going to indulge in tokenism or anything like that, but the title Token Female Podcaster, seems to be taken up now after a long search. And thanks to everyone who came on the show. Moving right along, Mr. Mark Lee.
I was waiting for the segue. Speaking of tokenism.
Speaking of tokenism, there's a man who lives a life of danger. Oh, I forget the verse. Did you write a verse?
I can't remember. Token Asian man. Token Asian man. That's me.
They've given you some nunchucks and made you eat fried lice.
Wait, what? That's offensive. That's offensive.
Oh, no. Good.
Okay, so my favorite depiction of Italian Americans. By the way, I'm the only person probably on this podcast who has Columbus Day off tomorrow.
I have Columbus Day off.
Oh,
it's
really?
A bank holiday. Yeah,
it is. That's a good point. You work for in the financial sector, and they get it off.
Interesting. Quick, interesting side note. It's not a market holiday, but it's a bank holiday. So if you work for a multi-service financial institution like I do, maybe you get the day off, depending upon whether you're focused primarily on investing or on banking services. So I have it off this year, but I haven't had it off in any previous year. Anyway, continue.
And you work for a municipal government, Mr. Lee. So
that I do.
You have it off.
I am going to
a public university, and I do not have it off, which is offensive to Italian Americans. I should not show up in protest because I'm like 1/16th or 1/8th Italian or something like that.
Are you really?
Yeah. My grandmother.
Forget about it.
My grandmother. Her name was Bonita Granville. Because she was half Italian and half French. Her mother was Italian and her father was French. So she got that improbable name. Google it if you want to see pictures of her, because she was a pretty lady back then in the 30s. What's your favorite depiction of Italian Americans?
Sure. What I have here isn't really necessarily a favorite, but I just want to use this opportunity to bring up the fact that back when I was in high school, I saw the awful parody movie Mafia before I had actually seen The Godfather, which I am pretty ashamed to say. I didn't enjoy the Mafia, and it's not a particularly excellent portrayal of Italian Americans in that film.
You don't think Lloyd Bridges and James Moore come off as convincing Italians?
You know, like, we talk a lot about believability and suspension of disbelief on this site, and that's got to be one of them that was stretching it, I got to say. Yeah, not so much. Anyway, Mafia is a very bad movie. It is, for a movie like The Godfather, which is deserving of quality parody, Mafia did not deliver on it. But it is, you know, ostensibly depictions of Italian Americans. So that's.
But I have to say one thing about that movie, to interrupt you again, because I love to interrupt you, is one of the things I love about that movie is the editing is just amazing. Like, just totally and completely amazing.
That's a good point.
Like,
you know, the cuts, you know, they really bring it up. It's funny that you mentioned that, you know, that it happens to bring up the editing. Would somebody like to Bring that
no,
up.
No, I don't think anyone wants to mention anything further on this subject. I think we're just going to roll.
You can IMDb it if you want to get if you want to get deeper into who who edited that movie.
Okay, and, continue, Mark.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark. Mr. Jordan Stokes, hey, you've been quiet.
Did Mark even answer the question? Oh. Did Mark answer the question at all?
I thought you liked Mafia. No.
No, I didn't like Mafia. I just wanted to bring up Mafia and just mention how ashamed I am that I saw Mafia before having seen The Godfather.
Oh, got it.
Well, it's no wonder you didn't like it. If you hadn't seen The Godfather yet, you didn't get what any of the jokes were about. Like when they have the guy whose name is like Big Baboon Ass on his shoulder, Larry, that's a reference.
And by the way, the movie's actual name is Jane Austen's Mafia, right? Which is like the best part of the movie.
Wait, is it really? I've not seen this movie.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Is it like by the Wayans brothers or something?
No, it's by the guy who did Airplane and Naked Gun.
Oh, well, I think those were superior
depictions of Italian Americans.
I think those were superior kind of zany comedies to the Wayans brothers scary movie, date movie, dance flick, epic movie.
That's not saying a lot.
Airplane and Airplane 2 are legitimately like really good comedies.
Oh yeah, they are. But like you know, date movie and dance movie are really at the bottom of the barrel, though.
Right.
You know?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, sure. Yeah. Setting the thing very low. Wow. Oh yeah.
I was just saying, I'm going to get you Sucka and Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood and Blank Man are all excellent.
Yeah.
Although those are the more heavy involvement of Keenan Ivory and the lesser involvement of Sean Marlin. And Damon. Also Damon. Damon's presence is always good, and David Alan Greer always makes them better. But anyway,
Damon and David Alan Greer were like Men on Film, I think, is a classic. That and like Fire Marshal Bill are the ones that I remember from In Living Color, you know?
Yeah. So does Mark
are you gonna answer? I thought you had answered because I'm not paying attention. I'm IMDBing to get my answer. But Mark, do you have a real answer?
No, not really.
It's your question.
I'm punting.
It's your own question. You suggested this before we started.
Yeah, no,
Say Rather's great grandma or whatever, because she's pretty hot, right?
Wait, I think more than anything else, I just wanted to brag about the fact that I have Columbus Day off. Suckers.
Are you going to go watch? Is there a parade? Like, are you going to go watch the parade?
I'm not going to watch the parade. You kidding?
No. Wow.
Is it that bad? Like, I don't really know what the Columbus Day Parade is like.
God,
is it like
Lee's an asshole. Lee moved to Park Slope and got all cynical about everything.
Yeah, pretty much. This is all just a big setup for me to actually really start just, you know, pooping on Italian Americans here.
You're going to end up engaged to an Italian American woman, and you're going to never want to show her this podcast ever. And you're going to have to like block the site on her browser. So she you're going to regret this someday. The Italians are a vengeful people, Mark. They'll come after you.
Pronounce it right. It's Italians. And come on.
And they'll salt the earth as they withdraw.
Mark Lee Delenda Est.
Korea Delenda Est.
Oh, man.
All right. Then from Park Slope over to that other part of Brooklyn. I don't know, Jordan, what part of Brooklyn do you live in?
Fort Greene.
Fort Greene. From Park Slope over to all the way down to Fort Greene, it's Jordan Stokes.
What's going on?
Not a whole lot.
So yeah, favorite depiction of an Italian American.
So yeah, Jordan's been sitting waiting to answer the damn question.
Oh yeah, I've been sitting on this one since I heard that was the question we were asking. My favorite depiction of an Italian American has to be Captain Lou Albano's depiction of Mario on the Super Mario Brothers live action TV show, and I'll tell you why. All right,
it's why? Because why, Jordan? Why?
It's a depiction of a fictional Italian American by another fictional Italian American who is himself being portrayed by a real Italian American of the same name.
So you're saying that Captain Lou Albano, the character, is the one who is performing as Mario, not Captain Lou Albano, the non-military officer, who's actually probably not a captain.
Yeah, not Louis Vincent Albano. Born July 29th, 1933. He is old.
Hey, by the way, fun fact, Captain Lou's brother was a health teacher at my high school, Carl Albano, peace be upon him. And he is a legendary figure among friends of mine. Definitely a marvelous, marvelous, charismatic man, much like his brother in many ways that you would not expect from a high school health teacher. So wherever he is, I hope that God smiles upon him. And on this Columbus Day, he celebrates being Italian and having been a high school health teacher. So,
what is that like? High school health teacher means like syphilis and whatnot, right?
Maybe in the like 1920s. No, it means that you have to memorize all of the STDs. They'd also the New Jersey curriculum. You'd have to memorize the real and ideal efficacy rates of all different kinds of birth control. Learn the different kinds of sexual transmitted diseases. We had a whole unit on family systems theory and like understanding alcoholism. And also things like smoking and stuff like that. So. I learned, I didn't have him as a teacher, so I don't know him personally. And there's some stuff about him that I can't share on this podcast, but maybe if people email me in private, I can give them the gossip. So
that's Fenzel@overthinkingit.com.
Yep, definitely.
That's okay. That's Jordan Stokes. Mine is Danny Aiello's portrayal of Salvatore Sal Fragione in Spike Lee's seminal classic, Do the Right Thing.
Good call. That's a really good performance as an actor.
Yeah, it's a more serious one, I guess. And that it really actually, like, speaking of otherness and speaking of, like, a clash of cultures and whatnot, like, there's a movie that delves into that whole territory.
Mm-mm-mm.
A lot of people in that movie who who are just starting out, Spike Lee, I guess, is in it, John Turturro's in it, Danny Aiello is in it, Ruby Dee is in it, Samuel Jackson is in it.
Young Rosie Perez is excellent in that movie.
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. And there's a great sex scene with her involving ice. And who plays Rahim? Bill Nunn as Radio Rahim.
Oh, he's great. He's in I just was laughing to myself because I think he's in The Last Seduction, right? In that movie where he gets killed in that movie. But he's also in Sister Act, I believe.
Yeah,
oh, sorry, spoilers for The Last Seduction. If you haven't seen that, like, 12-year-old, 15-year-old Linda Fiorentino movie. But yeah, he's in Sister Act. He's like the detective in the Sister Act.
Well, right. I mean, that's an interesting thing about him because, like, usually, I mean, people in entertainment, like film and TV actors, get pigeonholed as being a thing because, whereas in the theater, there's a tradition of kind of transforming yourself. And so you see people kind of take on things that are very far from them, very far from their actual type. I'm going to portray a Russian sailor with a limp, right, and one arm. And in the theater, you strap your arm down to your waist or something like that, and fake the limp and speak in a Russian accent. In film and TV, like, there are probably 20 or 30 Russian sailors with a limp and only one arm, and they have a list of credits. As long as that arm would be, if it were there, and they have like an agent at William Morris or something like that, and that's how that works. He's an interesting guy because like Do the Right Thing, Do the Right Thing. He was playing kind of an urban, young urban black guy part, and then he transitioned at some point to like detective, lawyer, authority figure. Kind of guy, right?
He's played cops a lot. He plays a lot of cops.
Cops, right? Exactly, like cop. Yeah. He was a that's who he was in Sister Act, for example. Yep. And I'm looking at his IMDb page, things like this, like Spider-Man 2 and 3, Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3 as Robbie Robertson, and on and on. I guess you don't see that a lot. Hey, if you haven't seen Do the Right Thing, you should definitely check it out.
It's
right?
The right thing to do.
It is the right thing to do.
It is the right thing. Well, my black friends and I in college used to play the Kevin Bacon game with Black Hollywood. Like, you weren't allowed to jump out of Black Hollywood until you got to like 1 degree away from Kevin Bacon. And he was definitely an important guy to know. So
Bill Nunn was an important guy to know.
Yeah. Although Omar Epps is probably the most important because he gets shot in every movie. That's his. That's what he gets cast as, right? It's like the guy who gets shot. Like, oh, he's just gonna get out. He's gonna survive. He's gonna make it out of the. Oh no, Omar Epps. Why?
Until until House, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, now he's a doctor because he got out of the ghetto because he proved to be invincible to bullets despite all of them hitting him all those years. But yeah. Good for him. Good for him.
Well, he was on – Omar Epps was on ER for like half a season once, right? Back in 96, 97, something like that, mm-hmm. when we were in high school.
It's really a huge accomplishment to be able to transition from young black guy who gets shot to black doctor and have that be like your role. Right, and like that's what you've retypecast yourself.
Well, I gotta say that like Pete's not even being facetious. That is really a big deal.
It is. It's a totally big deal. You recreate yourself as a new kind of character actor, which is a hard thing to do. It's hard enough to establish yourself as a top flight professional character actor in one kind of role,
right?
But
exactly.
To be able to jump around and do it in multiple kinds of roles, that's serious business. Like I think about David Koechner.
Yeah, to go from the baggy jeans and the oversized white T-shirt to the what does he wear? Suit and tie. Right,
yeah,
in
yeah,
lab
yeah.
coat. Actually, Foreman. Yeah. Foreman usually is walking around in a suit and tie. Everyone else wears a lab coat, but he's more dapper than that.
Stay classy, San Diego.
Oh yeah. All right. What's on the agenda for tonight? Oh right. So, Fenzel and Mark, you saw Zombieland.
Yes, we saw Zombieland. Definitely.
Oh yeah.
Yes, yes, and it is wonderful,
quality,
and I highly recommend it. Actually, I'm going to step aside. I'm going to let Mark talk for a little bit because I have a propensity to interrupt him, and I'd rather let him start talking so I can interrupt him.
Sure. So. let me start not without really talking about the movie itself, but about kind of the we talk a lot about spoilers on the site and on the podcast, and as you probably heard, there is a significant celebrity cameo in
Look,
this movie.
Don't reveal the spoiler, Mark. You can't reveal the. Don't reveal the spoiler, Mark. Don't reveal the spoiler.
No, I'm not going to spoil it.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I'm definitely
back
not.
Off. I'm going to let you talk again. I'm going to let you talk again and not interrupt you. But if you reveal the spoiler, I'm going to have to interrupt you.
No. Right? I would not do that. I would not reveal the spoiler. And the reason why I will not do it is because it has been done unto me, and I was not happy about this at all. And so what I want to actually do is kind of this, we want to talk about Zombieland in a second, but specifically around the nature of talking about spoilers and actually saying...
Mark, don't reveal the spoiler in Zombieland.
Don't reveal the spoiler. I'm not going to reveal the spoil. All right, let me just set this up. I was reading a blog post about Zombieland.
Well played, Fenzel. Right.
I do my best.
I was reading a blog post about Zombieland, knowing that there was this significant thing which could have potentially...
Rule of three is important in comedy, to do the rule of three.
I wasn't even expecting that one. That was very good. Well played,
All right, I'm totally done. Go ahead.
Are you done?
Three is done. Yes, I'm done. I'm finished.
Okay. In some ways, I kind of set myself up for this, but somebody basically typed in the comments that, just kind of casually tossed in, spoiler alert, I can't remember if it was all caps or not, but then proceeded to, spoil this thing which I'm talking about, and then commenters afterwards are like, hey, way to spoil it, guy, and that kind of stuff. So in reading this, I'm wondering, and after, realizing, oh, crap, I just spoiled it for myself, I'm wondering, was that sufficient, right, to type spoiler alert without any character turns or anything like that, kind of just in the middle of the sentence, in the middle of the comment? Mm-hmm. Is that enough to absolve yourself of that?
Do you need to put it at least on its own line, right, in all caps or something?
I think you need to put it on its own lines, on its own line. At the very beginning of the comment, say spoiler alert, and then, give at least a line, if not two.
Yeah. Well, because
you just established
you
that.
Yeah. Sorry. Now, that time, that was by accident. I didn't really mean to interrupt you there, Mark, and I apologize
okay.
for that.
So that being said, that was spoiled, and it did in some ways it did detract from my enjoyment of the movie and the surprise that comes along when you see it, which I'm not going to reveal. The one last thing I'm going to say about it on this subject is: do not look at the IMDb page for Zombieland if you haven't seen it and plan on seeing it, because it reveals the cameo, which I don't know, really blaming that on IMDb. I mean, I think they just kind of list the credits in the order which they are actually credited in the movie. That applies for both the audience as well as the other overthinkers on this podcast. Mm. That's just kind of my setup for that. I think, Fenzel, you're probably in a better place to, in a better position to describe why this movie was successful and what made it a lot of fun. I mean, that's the kind of the thing that that I keep coming back to. The movie was a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, it's really, really fun and funny. The I guess the I guess when I want to really explain why something is funny, I like to go back to something that my very first comedy teacher actually. He wasn't my first comedy teacher. He was the husband of my first comedy teacher. But he subbed in for like our first class, said, and this he was also Matt's comedy teacher. And he said that laughter is the response to the unexpected and the non-threatening. Right. And now granted, there's a lot to say around that and the words could be more precise. It's sort of a shorthand. It's a saying, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that something has to surprise you, but it does mean that there's a sense of discovery of something unusual in the core of most jokes, and that you sort of recognize it. And if you are too threatened by it, it's not funny. But if it confirms something you already know, or if it doesn't really make you feel awful, then like this unexpected thing, the reaction to it is to laugh. And Zombieland has a wonderful core game that it plays. And the thing that it reveals that is unexpected and non-threatening is that the characters in Zombieland have these wonderful, sincere sorts of relationships with each other. And they're these like wonderful, sincere characters who would belong in a totally different movie, right? They have like they're almost like Neil Simon characters. Except they're like a little bit more like Blue's Clues, like a little bit more sort of like smiley, one dimensional. But they've got this wonderful.
In that one of them is a cartoon dog, is what you're saying.
Yes, one of them is a cartoon dog.
Is that the cameo? Is the cameo Scooby Doo? Is that a
spoil dog? Spoil dog.
Yeah, the cameo is actually of Baby Bop, the younger sister of Barney the dinosaur.
Spoil it, dog.
But.
Not the
movie is about so
sorry,
the character
speaking of baby dinosaurs.
Speaking of baby, do you want to have a baby dinosaur conversation? Because we could totally do that. Triceratops babies,
oh, sorry, wrong large animal.
What are you even saying? What is that?
Stokes, you can explain that joke.
Well, that's a song called Baby Elephant Walk. And for reasons which are best known only to him, rather thought that everyone listening to this out there in America would hear that and know the song and get the joke.
I'm sorry, don't you think that like Henry Mancini is like in the overthinking it? Like, I think there's a in the overthinking it canon.
Well, the overthinking
if only because he's been featured in a joke on The Simpsons.
One of the charms of overthinking it is that there are a lot of things that are in the overthinking it canon and oeuvre that the overthinking it audience is completely oblivious to, and yet they forgive us for it.
Well, look, yeah, that's why I wrote, you know, these guys in the first place and suggested that we start this site because, like, I wanted my, like, smartest, most interesting, funniest friends to write articles about the things that they were fascinated by that I didn't know about. So I think that there is a function of overthinkingit.com that does where it is like introducing people to things that they might not know about otherwise. Mm. Like, for example, Dragon Ball Z. But, you know, back to Zombieland.
Right. Well, yeah, like, I mean, I guess it's easier to paint it out by examples. I mean, one example that's not too surprising is that that won't give anything away is that Woody Harrelson's character in this movie is sort of like an uber tough guy, kind of like roving cowboy zombie killer guy. He has a very specific, very clear sort of character, but he also has like some tenderness and some texture to him and some development, but it doesn't take away from how cleanly he participates in scenes. And his sort of his peg that he hangs his hat on as a character, that no matter how crazy the scenes get, you can come right back to it, is he loves Twinkies. And he's sad that Twinkies are becoming scarce in like post-apocalyptic world. Like, it's harder to get Twinkies because the zombies have taken over the country. So like he roves around like with machine guns, killing zombies, like looking for Twinkies. And there's a wonderful scene where he's like with the main character. He's like a 20-year-old guy who's kind of neurotic and obsessive compulsive, which is how he survives the zombie apocalypse. And they find a Hostess truck, and they open the Hostess truck, and the Hostess truck is full of snowballs, right? And so like, and this makes Woody very, very angry, and this makes like obsessive compulsive guy kind of happy because he likes snowballs and he eats them, and he picks them up and he eats them. And so Woody Harrelson is so mad, he's so mad. And like at this moment where like, you know, you think there's going to be a zombie that jumps out or whatever, but what he says is he's like, you know, I hate coconut. You know, it's not the taste, it's the consistency. And it's just, it's like, that, there's something that's so true about that. You know, like, I don't expect a character in a zombie movie to come out with saying something that is like a very true, very sincere observation about life that I can totally identify with, and that would have a part in a totally different kind of movie. Like, truth is so funny, and there's so much truth in this movie about the way that people interact and their neuroses and the things that they care about and don't care about, and so many fun little one-liners that just pepper through, and this real texture to the lives of these characters. And the movie is so much about the relationships among the characters. I was actually writing this on a message board earlier today when I was talking about this movie. The movie is so much about the relationships between the characters, and it isn't about the zombie apocalypse. So the logistical problems with portraying the zombie apocalypse are forgiven. Like, I feel like there's a lot of there's zombie movies get weighted down with all this baggage of having to explain why the zombie showed up, like what the rules are for killing the zombies, and like what happens when the zombies storm cities, and like how does it, you know, a lot of the fascination with zombie movies, a lot of people are fascinated by how would it work? What would the logistics of this massive cataclysm be? And part of it is a fascination with cataclysms and the logistics and people's responses and like modern society's safety nets and their fragility. And this movie doesn't bother with any of that stuff because it's about the people that are in the movie and their relationships with each other, and it gets to you with that, and it's so funny and it's so sincere and it's so honest that that you don't really care that it doesn't make sense that, you know, X number of zombies killed in what way, like Z moments, you know.
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head right there. That was kind of the thing that my friends and I walked out of the movie talking about, was the characters and how like this really wasn't a zombie movie in the typical manner of a zombie movie.
Yeah.
Right. I guess, and then what I kind of want to talk about with you and with the rest of the panel was, when we say that something is a zombie movie in the typical sense, like the Dawn of the Dead kind of sense, we mean something in particular, right? And part of that is the logistics as well. But to the credit of regular zombie movies, they're also about the characters and kind of what happens when you put people who, you know, strangers together in a very tense and stressful situation, an extreme situation, what happens to their personal interactions, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you put a bunch of, you know, you always have your core group of survivors, right? Mm-hmm. And then the zombie movie is not just about the zombies, but what happens to the group of survivors as well, mm-hmm. right? So what makes Zombie Land a different kind of zombie movie than the typical Dawn of the Dead kind of zombie movie?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'd go to my usual, and I mean, anybody else can jump in on this sort of general thing, but one of my usual things I harp on when I'm talking about classifying movies, Zombieland, in most zombie movies, the zombie apocalypse either changes the characters or brings something out in the characters that wasn't there previously. Like, we see how bestial they are, we see how capable of cruelty they are to each other, we see how brutal they are. The zombie movies are inherently dramatic because they're about characters, putting them through this crucible and seeing what changes them. Zombieland is a comedy, and it's a really good comedy. And one of the things that makes it a comedy is that it takes these characters and it subjects them to this horrible circumstance, and the characters themselves are not
that they probably don't deserve.
That's entirely accurate. You can say it that way if you want, and they don't change. Right, and I don't mean that there's Shaun of the Dead is also a zombie comedy, and that's sort of like a meta zombie comedy where you see the characters not changing from whom they are in a way that is in like relation to their environment. Right,
the scary movie of zombie comedies.
No, I wouldn't say that it's a scary movie.
No, it's probably better. Those guys are better than Simon Pegg is better than the Wayans brothers.
I mean, if I were to try to come up with a way of describing the difference between Shaun of the Dead and Zombieland,
It's tough.
Well, because zombie movies, you have the zombies and the main characters, and there's always this implication that the main characters are actually the zombies, right? They're like, oh, the main characters are the ones who are zombies. The zombies around them, you know, they're not that different from them than you might think, because they go about their boring day-to-day lives doing their normal crap, and like they don't have any inspiration in their lives, and they're bestial and they're cannibalistic on each other. Although they don't literally eat each other, they, you know, they ruin each other. And I think Shaun of the Dead is a bit like that, because, you know, they go to the pub and like that's all they do, and Shaun is caught up in his job. That's a dead-end job. So the zombie invasion shows you something about that character by comparison, right? Like this character is like the zombies because. And you have like, oh, there's like the annoying girlfriend who is like the zombies because, and there's like the father-in-law who's like the zombies because, and there's the fat video game playing friend who's like the zombies because. Zombieland isn't like that. None of the four protagonists in Zombieland are like the zombies. And I think that that's the biggest difference, is that the zombies cast the characters in Zombieland like in relief and heighten the things that they do with and around each other. It's not that it's reinforcing for you who they really are. It's that it's giving them a stage to play on where their idiosyncrasies really stand out, right? It's that the characters are really different. Now, great, and Woody Harrelson's character is very violent, and he likes the fact that he lives in this violent world, but there's a psychological depth to his violence, a reason for his violence that isn't really savage, and he doesn't really like hurting people, right? He's not like a great example is that Dawn of the Dead, like the classic Dawn of the Dead. I didn't see the new one. The central dramatic act of that movie, right, is one of the big central dramatic moments of the movie is when the bikers show up at the mall, and you have people who are inside the mall hiding from the zombies who fortified the mall, and then the bikers like raid the mall and loot it, and because the people can't get along, like the zombies get to break into the mall, and all hell breaks loose. So there's this sense that the people play and are violent in this violent environment, and they do horrible things to each other. But like Woody Harrelson's level of violence in this movie is like entertaining, and the characters sympathize with it, and it's about emotional freedom and catharsis. It's like, you know, and not catharsis because it's not really catharsis, but it's like it's more like you know, playing a video game or even just like, you know, smash, like beating a pillow or smashing up a bunch of I don't know, something that smashes. What's a good example of something that you can just break? Like knocking over a Lego.
Can I break in here for a minute? So what you're saying is that in the classic zombie movie like Dawn of the Dead, you'll see people doing these incredibly violent things as a way to cope with the zombies being around. And the movie makes you question whether this kind of violence might itself be harmful to the human spirit and whatnot. It makes us sort of consider why we think this might be fun. And Zombieland has people react violently to zombies being around, and the movie doesn't ask you to consider whether this might be toxic, and instead says, yeah, this kind of violence is really, really fun.
Yeah, I think so. I think that they acknowledge why we like to see people shoot zombies.
This makes it a good movie, you're saying?
Well, this doesn't make it a good movie. I mean, the fact that it's a good comedy makes it a good movie. This is just what makes it different from Shaun of the Dead. It's because in Zombieland there isn't a great deal of guilt or significance associated with killing the zombies. Like they're killed in a sort of Wile E. Coyote kind of way. They have this trope in the movie, or this motif in the movie called Zombie Kill of the Week, where they talk about like the most colorful and over the top way that like a zombie gets killed. There's like an example they show where a nun is being chased by a zombie and she rings a bell and somebody at the top of the church drops a piano on the zombie's head, and it's like very funny. It's very cartoonish, and I think that it's tricky because like cartoon violence. I mean, we live in a world where the barriers that kept violence cartoonish for political reasons have fallen, and so the violence that we see represented in our illustrative media like video games and animation and things like that, where you don't have to actually have people do it, tends to toward a sort of savage realism, a brutality, a gore. You don't see like Bugs Bunny style violence as much, and because I think you don't see it because of the political circumstances aren't there to create it, it's easy to forget what about it makes it sort of whimsical and fun and not savage. You know what I mean?
Could it be as simple as saying that Shaun of the Dead wanted to be a comedy, but also to be a zombie movie in the classic mold, whereas Zombieland really just wants to be a comedy?
Zombieland, the zombies are important to Zombieland.
But we were just saying, there's more to being a zombie movie than just having zombies, right?
Well, true. Zombieland is a movie that wants to be set in the setting of a zombie movie. Like it wants to be set in the world of Shaun of the Dead or of like Night of the Living Dead. It's more of, I mean, it's Fast Zombies, so it's more of a 28 Days Later, I guess, kind of situation. It's set in that world, but the characters are totally different.
And the concerns of the film in general seem to be totally different. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I'm picking up on what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't know. The concerns of the film are totally different. Like they don't, you know, they only really kill the zombies when they're in danger of immediately being eaten by the zombies. And there's a sort of freneticness to it that is not. I mean, you knowing you, Jordan, you would probably want to find the moral significance or lack thereof of these particular scenes, because on a degree they are troubling, but I don't think that it's as intrinsically a part of the metacinematic language of the movie here as it is in other zombie movies. Like, they're not hammering it into you like, oh my God, he's killing so many zombies, this is totally awful. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, no, I do know what you mean. I'm just saying that you're looking at the metacinematic language, and I'm saying that the meta cinematic language might be one that's more morally ambiguous than you're giving it credit for.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's violent to like the point of Ubu violence, like there's just like an Ubu being like the French like puppet influenced pre-Dadaist theater of like that the clown king who like pulls people apart when he gets angry, where like the violence gets so far over the top and sort of so indulgent that we all sort of laugh about why it entertains us. So in that sense.
Do you think it's really that violent there, Pete? I mean, the body count is certainly very high, but in terms of straight up...
but they're not people.
The zombie kill count is certainly very high, but in terms of the gore and graphic violence of it, I wouldn't go that far to say that. You know,
the gore level is really high, but
maybe I've seen some really gory horror movies that I was kind of desensitized.
But it's kind of a non-specific gore. Like, the zombies are all gross, and they, like, spit blood, right? Like, that's the one thing that these zombies do, is they sort of run around, but they don't run quite so fast that a character who is jogging briskly can't outrun them. But, like, they run. They don't walk. And when they're running, they're all goopy and gross, and they spit blood. And it's very sort of almost like Halloween gore. It's like gore that looks very fake. But it's pretty gory, and it's pretty gross at times. But it's, like, not... oh my God, I totally want to die because this movie is horrible gore, like, you know, Saw or Hostel or something. It's like, you know, ew, gross! Yeah,
I think that's what I meant. Not having seen Hostel or Saw, it's not gory to that extent.
Right. I mean, I haven't seen the
movie. It's like Double Dare gore, you're saying.
Yeah, you know what? It sort of feels like it feels like a zombie episode of Family Double Dare is really what it boils down to. It's not like Legend of the Hidden Temple, because that's sadistic. that is just freaking sadistic, because you never am able to get through the Shrine of the Silver Monkey. I'm sorry. The Shrine of the Silver Monkey.
I read on Wikipedia once that there was an episode of Secrets of the Hidden Temple where when the temple guard jumped out and scared the kid, she actually ran off the set.
The child?
Yeah. And they broadcast that?
Yeah, apparently so.
They put that on television? That sounds terrible.
Like, it's so scary. It was really a horrible
thing. I have something that I've been kind of thinking about for a while as this has been going on that I'd like you all to try on for size. The classic zombie movie, so, you know, Dawn of the Dead being probably the one where it's all laid down, Night of the Living Dead being a precursor text. Lucio Fulci's Zombie 2, you know, if you want to go for the advanced studies. The classic zombie movie is basically like The Wire. And that it's not really about the characters.
Because it has spoilers in it that you don't want to give away on the podcast.
Yeah. It's about the system, and then you put the characters in it and watch how it grinds them down.
Yeah, that is very well put. That's actually very, very, very well put, definitely.
As opposed to what? Like, I think we should be clear about what we're comparing it to. As opposed to the heroic type of movie where there's a kind of personal overcoming, right? And what matters really is individual agency.
Or about, say, if you keep it within the realm of horror movies, look at say Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street, any of those. Those are about people. Those are about contrapasso. You know, you have the kid who likes comic books too much, so he gets a comic book themed death, and so on. Whereas zombie movies aren't really about that. It's just about this impossible situation that people are in.
Any of the Final Girl movies is about. Is about something personal. Either you're a personal, either you have a personal failing that where you get your comeuppance, or else you're the girl who's the final girl, and you make it through.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, you know, if you watch enough slasher movies, you'll find that doesn't hold up quite so well. But the reason why, and I think this is very important to note, is that many slasher movies are just terrible movies. And they're going for that kind of, you know, resonance where people get what they deserve, the reward or the death that they deserve, but they're just shoddily written. So you end up with some things that are confusing where, like, the wrong person seems to die or the wrong person triumphs.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that the zombie that's very astute, and I one of the movies I tend to use to divide like horror movies on different sides of the spectrum is the movie Blade, right? Where it's like, do the characters in this horror movie are they capable and confident and comforting in the way that they are able to confront the evil that they face, right? Like, for me, like, Blade is about where you get to the point where you're no longer really scared for the hero because you know he's going to get through it okay. You know, and anything sort of south of Blade feels more creepy, like a horror movie, and anything north of Blade feels more like an action movie. But that's another sort of dividing point. But no, what you're saying is, yeah, you put people in the system grinds them down, you watch them grind you down, and that's kind of the horror of the movie.
So Blade is your, like, horror reference movie.
Blade is my Mason-Dixon line.
We've talked about before, like, I don't know if we've done it on the podcast, but Pete, you have talked before, and you and I have talked before about the like the reference movie, where every good thing about the movie is balanced out by something bad about the movie.
No, my movie along those lines, like my benchmark movie, where if it's better than this
movie, that's what you called it.
Yeah. My movie that's bad, if it's better than this movie, it's a good movie. And if it's worse than this movie, it's a bad movie. My benchmark movie is Rocky IV.
Mine is The Fifth Element.
See, I would put Fifth Element above Rocky IV, but I don't think it's surprising that I have a lower benchmark movie. Well, because Rocky IV has some wonderful moments, but it also has a lot of really boring crap.
I'd say that The Fifth Element has some really great moments, but also has a lot of shit in it, right?
Yeah, like, I was saying that Blade was my horror movie benchmark, where Blade is no longer a horror movie.
But this idea, I mean, I think this idea is very interesting, where there are certain films that thread the needle, either between good and bad, or else between different genres, and that if it's more X than Blade, it's an X movie, and if it's more Y than Blade, it's a Y movie. That's really interesting.
Now, if you
like that, because it's something that in like film studies, people go into great depth about what actually makes it a horror movie. And I think that the saying that if it's scarier than Blade, then it is a horror movie is a great way to just cut the Gordian knot. I'm gonna publish that shit, man.
Go for it. Just give me special thanks in the end. That's all I ask. So wait, do you guys have benchmark movies, Mark and Jordan, movies that you think that if it's better than that movie, it's a good movie, and if it's worse than that movie, then it's a bad movie?
Well, you're putting me on the spot here.
I am. Just like you put us on the spot with the freaking Italian Americans question. The only one didn't answer
the question. Yeah, the question that you had no intention of answering.
Yeah, that was kind of an asshole move on my part. I'm gonna make another asshole move here, and then kind of dodge that and
pose. You're entitled. That's fine.
Pose another question in the movie. I've heard in the recent days the coinage of the phrase zomedy. Is there now a sub genre of movies called the zomedy? And if so, then clearly Zombieland and Shaun of the Dead are in that category.
And as an insufferable pedant, how do you spell zomedy? Is it Z-O-M-B-E-D or is it Z-O-M-E-D?
Z-O-M-E-D-Y is what I was thinking. But that is certainly open to debate because I don't think this has really quite been codified just yet. But the question is, does that exist? And if so, what are other movies that fall into that category? And specifically, Grindhouse, the first half of Grindhouse, Planet Terror, does that qualify as a zombie? Because that really is kind of something else going on altogether in that.
Well, I'm trying to remember. No, Jordan and I have written the better part of a zombie, which we never finished.
That's true. One of these days. I would say that that Planet Terror probably is a zombie because it really is a parody of those movies. There are definitely actual zombie movies from the 70s out there that are just as weird and just as funny as Planet Terror, but the crucial thing is that they weren't trying to be funny, whereas Planet Terror pretty clearly was.
Yes, definitely.
What about Brain Dead, Dead Alive? Now, I wouldn't call it a zombie necessarily, but it's a comedy and it's a zombie movie. If, for those who haven't seen this, this is an early Peter Jackson movie from New Zealand, where it's about New Zealand in the 50s and social repression, and there's lots of zombies that get gored up in it. So what would you guys think about that? I mean, you've all seen that movie, right?
I have not, actually, no.
Oh, you haven't? No, Jordan, you've seen it, right?
Oh, yes. It's fantastic and deeply, deeply disturbing.
Exactly.
I don't know. It's tough. The comedy in that one is so kind of momentary and fleeting. And there are so many deeply, deeply horrific moments in it, you know, both in the sense of jump scares and, like, you feel bad about yourself the next day. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So yeah,
I have another one. I haven't seen it, but Fido, this came out recently, where zombies are used as, like, servants.
Oh, when did this come out? I'm going to look
it was
up.
2006.
It's not Phaedo, because that's something entirely different.
No, like I'm not sure what that is. But
Platonic dialogue, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, Socratic dialogue. Well, I mean, it's Plato, but doesn't he usually market it under Socrates' brand name?
Yeah, it's true. He released it under the Socrates label.
Because Phaedo is the crap dialogue about whether you should be afraid of turning into a zombie, right? Because there's part of you that is indivisible and immortal and all that stuff. But Fido, I wouldn't recommend Fido with the same force that I would recommend like Zombieland or My Cousin Vinny. But it is an excellent Socratic dialogue where he talks about death, and it's comforted me on some of my darker nights. So I recommend that. It takes place right before Socrates decides to kill himself. Spoilers! You can spoil Socratic dialogues and philosophy works, because if you don't know the end, then what's the point? So Fido, I've just killed enough time to look it up. It's a 2006 movie starring Carrie Ann Moss, which is a name that sounds familiar, but I don't know who the hell she is.
She was the chick from The Matrix. She was Trinity in The Matrix.
Oh, Trinity. Oh, so Trinity made another movie. Good for her. And it's got somebody named Kay Sun Ray in it, which is a pretty funny name.
IMDb does file it under comedy, drama, horror, and romance. So at least it does have that comedy aspect to it. I know, if any of the listeners have actually seen this movie and can comment on, you know, if it actually is a zombie, then please do show us in the comments.
It won a lot of awards. Not a lot of prestigious awards, but a lot of awards. Like, it won a bunch of Leo Awards, which are in Vancouver, British Columbia. It's an industry event for film and television in Canada. So it won a bunch of, I guess, Canadian film production awards. Is it a TV movie? Maybe that would explain it. I'm
sorry, is it a what movie?
Oh, TV movie. Is it like North and South, like a miniseries or a TV movie? Or like,
No. I believe it was actually a proper theatrical release.
It's a proper theatrical release. Okay, fair enough. Anyway. But at any rate, I don't know. It's got a pretty... I've been told I sound like a robot.
You've gone Skypey. There's nothing to be done. We actually were called out for this in the comments, in the show notes on our last...
You said you were doing something about it.
I am doing something about it. I definitely Googled Skype call quality, and it seemed very difficult to fix. So I did not... I haven't.
Well, at that rate, then, I think we should award you the Nobel Prize for Skype quality fixing.
Zing!
Oh.
Wow.
We're going topical.
The inner redneck has come out in you, hasn't it? What, do you resent our nation's 44th president being granted that honor?
Not so much of resent isn't the quite word. I think it's premature. That's all I'm going to say about that. I really don't want to open this can of worms here.
Well, I think it should have gone to an Italian. Okay. When was the last time the Nobel Peace Prize went to an Italian? They are racist against Italians. That's what I'm saying. No Italian has ever won the Nobel Peace Prize, which is probably false because I didn't even bother to look it up. But I'm going to say it. And it's because the Nobel Committee, because the Swedes are viciously anti-Italian and racist. And the Norwegians mostly, because they're the ones who decide the Nobel Peace Prize. But, all right, that's
well, they're kind of like a death panel, except, you know, for not winning the Nobel Prize, if that makes sense.
So wait, is anything that makes any sort of decision by committee a death panel now? Is that how it works?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I guess in American Idol that makes sense. To face the death panel. Has anyone watched America's Best Dance Crew? I enjoy that show. I watch it on the treadmill sometimes, and they throw a lot of really silly words into it, you know, like b-boy style, and they're, you know, it's never okay just to say, like, these guys did a great job. It's like, you guys were smokifying, but you guys, it's, but spectacular. I don't even say spectacular.
You know, I don't see any. I don't see any Italians. I'm looking at the list of Nobel Peace Prize. I don't see anyone who immediately jumps out as being Italian.
Start a petition. Start a petition because this is prejudice and will not be tolerated. It will not be tolerated. The Italians used to be the victims of tremendous racism in the United States and in Europe. They were considered to be inferior to whites under the three race theory. They were considered to be part black, actually, and they were considered, I believe, I read once that it was once believed that the average intelligence of an Italian man was equal to the average intelligence of a retarded German man. And this was stuff that people actually believed in academia and
yeah,
published
that's,
in
that's like what back with like phrenology and whatnot.
Yeah. So like, you know, 100 years ago, not that long ago.
Guys, sorry to piss on your parade, but in 1907, Ernesto Teodoro Moneta, president of the Lombard League of Peace, got the prize. So evidently there is never.
The Italians have triumphed.
Evidently there has never been any prejudice against Italians of any kind ever.
I'm cheered by this victory, and I'm glad the Italian people were able to pull together and make it happen.
Well, you know, I think we've talked about this actually on the podcast before in terms of, you know, Italians as the other and that sort of thing, and also in kind of the shifting definition of ethnicities in the United States, and that. Oh, Italians used to not be considered as "quote unquote" white people in America, right?
Sort of like,
yeah, but that's you know what that's
Koreans.
I mean, the Irish, who are as white as anyone, were considered not white people for a long, you know, for a long time. Every wave of immigration goes through that.
Every wave of European immigration goes through that. I mean, clearly, I don't think, you know, like folks like myself, like an Asian American, would ever be considered. You know, as part of the white pantheon.
First of all, don't speak prematurely. These are things that have happened over hundreds of years. I mean, you're seeing it. I mean, look at Cubans who live in Florida and so on and so forth. But secondly, I would say that it's definitely present in the Asian population in degrees because there's definitely barriers between, you know, like if you were Vietnamese, you would probably have a very different racial experience than if you're like Japanese or like Han Chinese or Korean, I think, in most parts of the United States, at least if you're got, you know, a relative amount of education and resources in your family. Like people from Indochina suffer a lot more structural racism. Now, granted, most white people aren't even aware of this, but it has to do with like neighborhoods and housing and social capital and like where they, you know, where they get jobs and stuff like that. So, I mean, I think that and even if Asians don't get considered white, because it would be kind of silly to say that they have the same skin color, you could probably say that they can assimilate.
And Pete is back. Like, your sound quality is back. I don't even understand why it is.
It's another wonderful victory of the Italian people. Marconi helped me out. But yeah. So, I mean, maybe what I'm saying is Harold and Kumar is whiteness by other means. I amuse myself with that.
I don't want to get us too far down into this rat hole here, but the test that I always use is for this assimilation point of view is a very
superficial. You just compare white people to rats. That's not very nice.
Yeah, Art Spiegelman.
Oh. All right.
Yeah, I had something to say, but you know. <about it. laughs>
I think that's pretty much – I'm tapping it out on that one. I think I can go past that. Oh, man. So Fido.
Bad.
Fido, I don't recommend Fido because I haven't seen it. I don't know anything about it, and the IMDb page has not helped me out. So what have you. So – oh, boy. So, guys.
Yes. Thanks. Thanks for driving the podcast. I know that's supposed to be my job. I just haven't seen Zombieland, so I figured I'd sit out the conversation for the most part.
Well, I don't know. Parting words about anybody else have parting words about zombies and Zombieland? Because I mean, how are we running on time now, Matt? I know our listeners' time is valuable, and we don't want to burn.
We're coming up on an hour of podcast, so we should probably pack it in pretty soon.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'll offer my parting thought about the zombie movies, and it'll be a little of a recap of what I said before, which is that, you know, the character of a zombie movie is dependent upon the metaphorical relationship between the main characters of the zombie movie and the zombies. How is the experience of the main characters similar to the experience of the zombies, and how is it different? And I would say that in Zombieland, it is on the side of very, very different. They are sort of looking for a non-zombie existence. These are people who who have not resigned themselves to zombiehood, and they're looking for meaningful social connection in a world where they can't find it. And that's the moral of Zombieland, right? Is that, like, you know, you're surrounded by people you don't connect with, you're terribly alone, find other people and you'll be happy and you'll be satisfied. Whereas, like, Shaun of the Dead, it's like a little bit different because, you know, you're living a life that is ground down by routine and by homogeny, and maybe your solution is to try to become a hero, and that's a little bit of a different vector. But that if you want to have a vector on which to approach your own analysis of zombie movies, look to the relationship and the role that is being played by the people relative to the role that's being played by the zombies.
And if you don't know what the vector is, ask, what's the vector, Victor? Do you have clearance, Clarence? Roger.
Roger. Roger.
Yes, I'm serious, and don't call me Shirley.
I think we have a title now.
Any other parting thoughts?
A test case for that would be what? Which one is it? Dawn of the Dead, where they're in the shopping mall?
Well, yeah, sure, because in the Dawn of the Dead movie, the zombies' main behavior is that they continue to flock to places that were familiar to them in life, right? That's a characteristic that the zombies in that movie have that they don't have in a lot of other zombie movies. The zombies, like, continue to walk back and forth to, like, the store in their house, even though they're dead and shambling around. And so the people behave like the zombies because they go to the shopping mall. Right, which is like the place that they would go to in life to find refuge, which is comparing them to the zombies, saying that they don't have things that are sort of like intrinsically active and valuable about the choices they make and what they do with their time. And the way in which they sort of cannibalize each other and fail to value each other and betray each other over the course of that movie also compares them to the zombies and their cannibalism and their inhumanity and their lack of coherence or capacity for compassion.
Right, the drive to consumerism is not necessarily all that different from the drive to brains.
Well, I don't think that at that point the drive to brains was such an independent social phenomenon that it was like something that was worth comparing things to for its own sake. I think that it's more a criticism of consumerism. So, like, now we have this imagination that Zombieland is a real place, but of course it's not.
My last thoughts on Zombieland are simply that under no circumstances should you allow yourself to have the special part of it spoiled. So
if anyone does it in the comment threads, we will find you and we will get you.
Yeah, it was on Slash Film. So watch the discussions of Zombieland on Slash Film where the spoiler was.
Yeah, or any film blog, to be honest, because, you know, where people are talking about this movie, they're going to want to talk about this. And it is actually kind of, I'm like holding it in here. There's all these kind of fun parts of the movie that I wanted to talk to people about. But this is not the place for that. So,
you know,
go out.
I usually don't go watch horror movies because I am a big wuss. But I may go see this one because you guys recommend it so highly.
As horror movies go, as it kind of related to my earlier comment, it's not so awfully uncomfortable. You know, to the point where you just rather you were with me when we saw the preview for, was it the Jason movie Friday? I can't remember what the hell they're called anymore. That awful slasher horror movie.
Leprechaun.
Comic-Con. We saw the 5-minute long.
It was the remake of Friday the 13th. And Mark, that, I gotta say, like, that was actually even pretty tame as far as some of your, like, extreme torture porn goes, like Hostel 2 or the Saw franchise. Movies that I can't abide. Like, I don't see what the pleasure is. You know, like, we go to entertainment for pleasure. And I don't know. I see the pleasure in like, a Tarantino level of violence in the context of a story. But I don't see the pleasure in a minimal story in the context of a, you know, brutal level of graphic violence. I don't know. Stokes, you're a devotee of horror movies. Maybe you can set me straight.
As to what's the pleasure of the torture porn kind of thing?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I understand that Hostel is actually probably I've heard that it's a really well thought out movie and that it's about kind of the ugly American and tourism and exploitation.
Yeah. I mean, Hostel has a certain amount of stuff going on under the hood. But the fact remains that you could have made those points without having the torture porn, right? So, like, that's there too. You can't pretend it isn't. I think that a lot of it has to do with just sort of a kind of brinkmanship that goes on when you start watching horror movies. Or call it, what's the phenomenon? If you become a heroin addict, you need more heroin to get the same effect,
okay,
right?
Okay, sure, yeah.
Tolerance,
yeah. You build up a tolerance to gore. And because horror movies are largely consumed by either adolescent males or people who have the psychology of adolescent males, there's a certain cachet.
It's all of us. It's all of us.
There's a certain cachet to being like the toughest one on your block, to being able to sit through the really, really unsettling horror movie. And you combine those two phenomena, and like, I don't think that anyone is meant to go in and see Saw as the first horror movie that they've ever seen and be like, that was really cool stuff. But if you've watched, you know, Land of the Dead, which has some raw stuff in it, then going in and seeing Saw, you can come out and say, that actually disturbed me. I haven't seen a horror movie in a long time that disturbed me. And there's sort of an, I don't know, a goodness about that in a certain way.
Okay. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, I guess if that's the kind of experience, I mean, if you value that experience.
Keep in mind, this is a generation of kids that has been raised on hyper-violent video games and stuff, so they're very desensitized and tolerant of, like, ultra-gore and ultra-violence. So, like, even if they're fairly young and haven't seen all these other horror movies, like, it's going to be impressive to them to be able to show that much blood and guts.
Sure, yeah. And more than that, that much pain, because it's not really, I don't think, the amount of blood that really changes. But there's a focus on human suffering that's there in those movies that isn't really there in, you know, in your Friday the 13th, where, like, you know, the person dies pretty quickly and then there's just a large stain. Mm.
That's what she said.
Yeah. I have a final word on zombies, which is that let no one think that the zombie is actually a new genre. There's a movie that I can recommend very highly to you all called King of the Zombies, which is in the public domain. So you can go watch it on archive.org if you want to. Now, like any zombie comedy, you have to put up with a certain amount of stuff that makes your stomach twinge a little bit. And here, rather than gore, what you have to put up with is racism. It's a very racist movie. However, Mantan Moreland, who is familiar to most of you all as the guy that the Beastie Boys sample on that Dick and the Mashed Potatoes song, he's sort of the African-American lead in this. There's the white leads and the black leads. And I don't know if it's the writers or if it's just him, but clearly that character is smarter than everyone else in the movie, and smarter, in fact, than the movie itself. So while the film is racist, you can sort of latch on to that guy and his point of view, and it sort of stops being racist, and it's tremendously enjoyable.
When was the year of this movie?
1941.
Oh, and so they were making zombies back in 1941, like before America entered the war. That's impressive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, well, if you want to join the conversation about zombies, about Italian-Americans, about tokenism and the minority experience, about spoilers and violence, or if you want to suggest, this is a good one, if you want to suggest a reference movie, that is to say, a movie where, in some respect, everything that is good about it is balanced out by something that's bad about it, and vice versa, like where the needle is exactly at zero on some continuum from negative infinity to positive infinity, what you should do is leave a comment on the show notes, use the contact form on the site, email us at podcast@overthinkingit.com, or call the podcast voicemail, which is 20-EAT-LOG-01. That's 203-285-6401, 203-285-6401. I keep promising a listener feedback show, and I think we're going to do one next week. So get those in before, say, Friday or Saturday, and we will try to pull them all into next week's show. Little housekeeping note: we're going to stop putting the Gossip Girl and Glee podcast. We're going to stop putting that on this feed. It's going to be on its own feed. So if you are interested in the These Effing Teenagers podcast, which, you know, you notice I don't use the true name of that podcast because this is a PG-13 and spoiler-free show, whereas that is a that's a hard R. That show is a hard R. and
yeah, you get to see rather topless on that one.
You really do. We do more than like five thrusts, right?
It's like pirate porn. It's hard R.
And scene.
And we don't respect anybody's sensitivities about spoilers on that show. So we may spoil the Zombieland cameo just to spite you on the Glee show. And that's because Ryan Sheely and I don't care about our audience in the way that the Overthinking It podcasters care about our audience on this show. So you're going to have to subscribe to that show separately in iTunes or on the site or however you do it if you want to see it. Just one little housekeeping note. One more time, it's podcast@overthinkingit.com or 203-285-6401. But until then, visit us on the web at www.overthinkingit.com, the site that subjects the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.
It probably doesn't deserve.
Sorry, that was insensitive.
Sorry.